Okay. All right. Thank you to the praise team. Meet with me in the book of 2 Samuel, chapter 15. 2 Samuel follows after 1 Samuel. Chapter 15 comes right before chapter 16. All right. In my Bible, it's page 238 and 239. And I know that, honestly, only applies to Peggy, so. Anyway, 2 Samuel, sorry, chapter 15. We're going to look at verse 24 through 26. Okay, actually, we're going to look at the entire chapter, but the focus is going to be on 24 through 26. Let me read for us. Now behold, Zadok also came, and all the Levites with him carrying the Ark of the Covenant of God. And they set down the Ark of God, and Abiathar came up until all the people had finished passing from the city. And the king, King David, said to Zadok, return the Ark of God to the city. If I find favor in the sight of the Lord, then he will bring me back again and show me both it and his habitation. But if he should say thus, that I have no delight in you, behold, here I am, let him do to me as seems good to him. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So we are continuing in our series in the life of David. We're actually drawing to a close. There's only a couple more things. And I think this is another part of the life of David that a lot of people don't realize, okay? Which is that David actually had a failed coup attempt on his government, okay? For all of you young bucks, okay? A coup, do you guys know what that is? A coup d'etat? Okay, a coup d'etat is a term basically which means an overthrow of a government. Okay. So when you guys like learn government or civics or history class, you learn all about all these coups. Okay. There's all over the place, mainly in Europe. Okay. The only thing I can think of right now is, for some reason, is Russia. Okay. So Russia used to be a monarchy. They used to have a king, and then around 1917, 1919-ish area, can't remember. They had a coup. The Russian, was it the Bolshevik Communist Revolution? Okay, so the communists overthrew the monarchy. Okay, and so Russia went from monarchy to communist. Okay, that's a coup d'etat, change in government. Okay, and so that's, so King David survived it. There was a coup attempt on his government, but it failed. So again, this is another part of David's life that a lot of people don't realize. Everyone thinks, oh, David was all happy, he was always good, he never had a bad day in his life. No. David had a lot of bad days in his life. Okay? This is a chapter 15 in 2 Samuel is the story of that coup. For David, though, it is a little bit more personal, and I think a little bit more painful for David than most modern government coups that we know of, mainly because David's government came under attack from his own son, one of his own sons. Okay, and so David had a lot of kids. He's king, so he's got a lot of kids, and David. Like I said, everyone thinks, oh, he's always good. He's good at everything. He's the Renaissance man. He's like Johnny. He's always good at everything. Okay? No. Okay, David had his successes and he had his failures. He has strength and weakness. One of his weaknesses is that he really couldn't manage his family. Like, he was not a good dad. We know this because he had messed up kids. so messed up, in fact, that one tried to kill him and become king. Okay, Absalom is the guy that we're talking about here. And so we left last week in chapter 12, okay, with the child, the death of the baby that David had with Bathsheba, the first one. And at the end of chapter 12, they had another baby named Solomon. Okay? Solomon. Okay? And so there's a whole other thing there. But Solomon, okay? Cool kid. Cool guy. In any case, so fast forward. And so Absalom also, just says, this is what y'all need to go home and read the Bible, okay? Because I don't have time to go through all of this. Anyway, just give me a quick heads up, okay? So, Bathsheba and David have another kid named Solomon, okay? And we all know about Solomon. The following chapter actually show this other story about David's kids, and he had several, okay? And they're all crazy. Like, they're straight up, they're really, really crazy. It's like the Brady Bunch in a really, really bad way, okay? And so, basically, one of his sons had a crush on his half-sister. And basically, he ended up raping her, okay? And this girl was actually full, they shared the book, same mom with Absalom, the guy that we're going to talk about today. And so Absalom ends up basically killing his half-brother in revenge for raping his sister. Okay? So this is all within the family. Okay? And so, any case, so that a lot has happened since chapter 12. Chapter 15, what we see is Absalom plotting and beginning the attempt to take over the government of Israel. And David has to deal with it. And there's a lot of different things that happen that David faces, which mirrors or kind of foreshadows what Jesus will go through. Okay? And our small group, Jay, remember, we talked about that a little bit, remember? King David and Jesus. All right? So, in any case, and so what happens is, Absalom goes to a city and he gets a lot of people hyped up. So a lot of people are like, yeah, David, you know, he was good, but that's in the past. So David's time is past. We need a new king. We want Absalom. Yeah, he's young. He's good looking. Okay, and the Bible says he's good looking. Right? And he's got beautiful hair. Right? It's interesting that for some reason the first couple like king people the Bible describes as good looking. Saul was a handsome man. David was a good looking man. Okay? Absalom was a good looking man. Okay? This just to go to show you that just because you're good looking don't mean anything, okay? Because Saul was bad, Absalom was bad. Okay. Anyway, so Absalom was a good looking man, and so he goes to the city and he rallies people around him. He even gets government officials. He even gets the people that work for his father to actually come on his side. Right? And so what we see in chapter 15 is that Absalom now has some popularity, government official, and even some troops. And so what they're going to do is they're going to march on the capital city of Jerusalem. David hears about this, and he completely outmaneuvered. He has no standing guard, per se, okay? Like, he doesn't have, he's not like Nebuchadnezzar, or he's not like, you know, the Babylonian king in 300. He doesn't have the immortals or anything like that, okay? It's just him and his wives and his, like, priests, stuff like that. And so he thought, oh, snap, what are we going to do? Okay, so they're like, okay, we got to run away. All right, so that's the situation. And so David is fleeing the capital, and because he's the king, and he takes a lot of the priests and the prophets with him, the priests, what they do is actually go and take the Ark. Ark of the Covenant. Ark of the Covenant, remember, was this huge golden box. right, which represents in those times the presence of God. And so they take the Ark of God and they try to take that with him. Okay, and so this is why David, in our passage, says, no, don't take it with me. We're leaving it here. And we're going to talk about why. All right? So anyway, that's the basic gist of the story. There's three lessons that we want to kind of focus on. First one being that God is God. Okay. God is God. What the heck does that mean? It's this. This is the part where I'm focusing on the part where David says, no, don't take the ark with us. Leave it where it is. Okay? Now, why is that such a big deal? It's this. Back in the day, and even today I would imagine, pagan worship. Okay? If you're on the move, you take an idol or a little trinket with you. It's a symbol of that deity going with you. Okay? So like if you watch like Gladiator, like all real guys have watched Gladiator, right? I don't know if all you guys have seen Gladiator. Gladiator is a very good movie. There's a lot of good things to be learned from. Anyway, Gladiator. If you watch Gladiator, there's this one scene where it's a story about a Roman general named Maximus. Maximus, that's a strong name. Maximus. All right? And he basically gets screwed over. And he goes from general to a slave, and then he becomes a gladiator. And in the midst of all these things that happen, he still has these little things, little, I guess, toys or wooden toys that represent his family and the Roman gods that he prays to. Okay? So it's kind of that same idea. And so what you do is you take it with you. The problem is God is God. Okay? You don't do that with God. You don't mess around with God, period. Okay, so David's lesson in this is that we're not taking the ark because we're not going to treat God like any other small g god deity, in that we're not going to manipulate God and take his ark with us. You see that? Okay, so what David is trying to say is, hey, check this out. God is king. Whether we go and come, that's up to him. We don't move God. God moves us. You see that? Because if you think about it, the popular average king in that situation that David finds himself in, it would be obvious to him to take the ark with him, right? Because it would be, you know, we're gonna take the favor of God with us, if you will. Right? That's the kind of the idea. If we take the ark of God with us, Absalom's gonna lose, and we're eventually gonna come back, and we're gonna be good. But that's not what David says at all. Right? David says, no, no, no. The ark stays in Jerusalem. I think part of the reason why David says that is because Jerusalem is the capital. Right? And who lives in the capital? The king. The president. Okay? President lives in Washington, D.C. He doesn't live in Fairfax or whatever. Okay? He lives in Washington, D.C. I think part of the reason why David says, no, the ark is going to stay in Jerusalem, is because he's trying to remind himself and say to the people around him, hey, guess what? I may be king, but I'm just an earthly king. The real king is God. And this is how David can say, you know what? If God will have me, we will return. If not, then we won't. Either way, God is still king. That's what he's saying. Most people can't say that. I can't say that, even today. It's, you know, it goes against the grain on almost every single generation that's lived on this planet. Because David, especially David as a man in power, is man in position and title. Because what does Jesus say? Jesus says it's very, very difficult. He doesn't say impossible. It's very, very difficult for rich people to get into the heaven. Right? That would be David. David was a very rich man, very powerful man. But he still got there. How? Because I think David never lost sight of the fact that he may be earthly king, but he's not the real king. Furthermore, we know David was literate. That's a very, very, very big thing in the Old Testament. Kings need to be literate, especially for Israel. Why? Because one of the jobs of the king is to read the Bible and to teach it to the people. Okay? Now, we know that David is literate because why? He wrote a whole bunch of the Psalms. Okay? So if you could write it, you could read it, and you understand it. All right? And so, David, being able to read and write, read the Old Testament, read the Bible. He read Genesis. He read about how God is the creator king. He read Exodus. He read about how God is a saving king. And he read the Judges, and he read the early history of Israel. He heard it. How they were theocracy. And though Saul became a king, David clearly knew that Saul might have been the earthly king, but it was still up to God. God was still in charge. So he knew that though he might be king, in reality, he was no higher than vice president. Because God was the one with the real power. Right? This is the lesson, that God is God, that we are not. In the history of Israel, David would have been aware of this. If you look at 1 Samuel chapter 4, if you flip back in your Bible a couple of chapters, 1 Samuel chapter 4, Israel actually does what David refuses to do, which is to take the ark and treat that like a little trinket of divine favor. Oh, as long as we have this, we're going to be good. Right? So 1 Samuel chapter 4 is a story about Israel fighting with Philistia. Okay, the Philistines. They hate the Philistines and they hate each other and always fighting. Okay? And Israel is getting their butt kicked. And they're like, what should we do? I know. Let's go get the ark. And if we get the ark, then we're going to win. Right? Notice the contrast between that thinking and David's thinking. David saying, refusing to take the ark. And these people are saying, oh, let's do it. That's a great idea. Everyone else is doing it. You know? And so they take it and they get their butt kicks anyway. And that's how Philistia ends up taking the Ark of the Covenant for a while. Okay? Thank you. So 1 Samuel chapter 4, that, you know, it's an interesting story there. And so again, David is saying, he, regardless of title, power, position, he, like the other people, are still subservient or under the rule of, under the control of God. God is king. We are not. Furthermore, we see in Daniel chapter 2 that it is God who raises up kings and brings them down. Right? And David saw this in Saul. Saul came out of nowhere. Before Saul was king, no one knew who he was. Other than, hey, you should play basketball. You're a pretty tall guy. That's basically it. Right? But Saul comes out of nowhere, and all of a sudden, he's king. And then he gets full of himself, and God brings him down. So David knows this very well. Right? That regardless of human title, it is God who is in charge. Now, what does that have to do with us today? Check this out. That was a couple of thousand years ago. Today, in the church, right? Israel, in a lot of ways, reflects the modern-day church, for the good and the bad. But for this lesson, right, that Johnny and I, regardless of our title, our position, doesn't matter, because God's still in charge. Okay? So what that means is, you know, if you don't like any of the stuff that we're saying, you complain to God. Okay, it's not up to us. Okay, God tells us what to do. All right, if we're doing our jobs correctly, right, John? So it is God who rules and who moves. David knew this very well. God is God. Second lesson: man is not. Okay, this is from a couple sources. It's from a song, it's also from a line, from a message, from Matt Redman's pastor, who said it like this: God is God, I am not, and he's quite content in keeping it that way. Okay? God is God. I am not. And he's quite content on keeping it that way. All right? So the second lesson, the man is not, or I am not. Okay? So God is God. We are not. Therefore, it is logical, makes sense, that since he's God, then we're not, then it's logical that we obey him, that we bow down to him, right? And I understand that's a very, very unpopular thing to say these days, right? That God is in control. We don't like that. You know? I've met a lot of people who said, yeah, I like God. God is cool. But I don't like the idea of God being in control of everything. Because we want to be able to control God. We want him to be in a box that we could open and close whatever we want. Because then he's not so dangerous. Then he's like a nice cute pet. A cute pet Jesus. Okay? He's like a cheetah pet. You give him some water, you give him some sunshine, and he grows. He's all happy, but that's it. You just keep him on your window. And so when people come over, you're like, oh, look at my chia pet Jesus. He's cute. He's growing. It's all good. And so people are like, oh, you have a chia pet Jesus. You must be very religious. Clap, clap, clap. Snap, snap, snap. Good for you. But that's it. Problem is, that's not what the Bible says. The Bible doesn't describe Jesus as a nice chia pet hobby. Okay? Jesus, if anything, is described as like a wrecking ball. Comes crashing into our buildings. So we're just chilling in our rooms and doing whatever we want to do. All of a sudden, we hear, and you're like, what the heck is that? And then all of a sudden, a wrecking ball comes crashing through your window. Right? That's Jesus. Jesus isn't little chia pet, you know, hobby. Jesus is a constructor, you know, destroyer Jesus comes into your room, you know, with a wrecking ball, with a constructor hat on, and goes, we're about to do some demolition here. I'm going to rebuild this whole house, so you need to get up out of here. Right? That's Jesus. All right? So we are not. So God is God, okay? Part one, we are not. I think in many ways, especially today, 2012, that is a harder lesson to swallow than the first lesson. Because almost everyone can say simply, yeah, God is God. The latest survey of the average American religious view has us around anywhere from 70 to 85% of Americans on any given day, if you survey them, will say that they believe in God. Okay? So the fact that God is God and you acknowledge that, that doesn't really separate you from other people in this country. Almost everyone they have no problem with that, okay? The problem where people, the problem arises when we go, if God is God, then we are not. God is very secure in his identity, and he's not willing to share it. This is who I am, you're not me, right? There's this distinction between God and us, okay? Now, there's this all, you know, there's a new wave of new Eastern religion mumbo-jumbo. It's like a hybrid of like Buddhism and, you know, Hinduism and throwing a little bit of Japanese Shintoism and all of this stuff. And then it's all of a sudden, everything is God. So we are a part of God. So, you know, if you want to see a part of it, go watch Oprah. Okay? It's just Oprah all the time. Right? Especially the part where she's like, everyone gets a house, right? Well, before that, she's like, okay, but everyone's God, okay? And so you're like, really? Okay? So the modern popular trend in religion says that there is no distinction between God and his creation, that we are a part of God somehow, okay? No. Okay, that's just a lie. It's a philosophy of man. It makes no sense, right? God is God, okay? Because what they want to deny is God's ability to create something out of nothing. Because their logic is, oh, that doesn't happen in the universe now, so how could that ever possibly happen? No, because he's God. He has that power. Right? In Hebrew, the verb is bara. God has bara. Genesis 1:1. God bara out of heavens and the earth, out of nothing. He created something out of nothing. Okay? So God is God. We are not. And that is these days seen labeled as too old school, too traditional, narrow-minded, bigoted, hateful. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff I could say to that, but it's not the point here. And so, we can easily get into this thinking that, you know what, I don't want to submit myself to God because Jesus is all about freedom and love. Submission sounds a lot like slavery to me. That's what the modern mindset would say. Right? And if you think about it, you know, we kind of have that mindset. We don't like being told what to do. You know, I'm 30-something years old. You know what? My parents still tell me what to do. I don't like it. I still do it most of the time. Right? We have this rebellious spirit. We don't want to be told what to do. We especially don't like it when our siblings tell us. I don't know what that feels like because I'm the oldest brother. So I just told my brother to do something and I expect him to do it. Otherwise, there's violence going on, right? But, you know, but parents, they still do it. You don't like it, but they still do it. And so it's kind of this, we have this weird, like, tension. Oh, God is God. That's great. But we're not. Uh-oh. So what does that mean? The conclusion is if God is God and we're not, then we have to submit to him. We have to do what he says. And we don't like that. Because we see that as obligation. We don't like that word, obligation. The modern day Christian vocabulary is filled with things like love and grace. But it is strangely empty of words like obligation and duty. Problem is the Bible has all of those. It has love, it has grace, it has mercy, but it also talks about duty. It talks about obligation. Right? And the craziest thing is the Bible said that when we submit to God, right, here's a little twist, right? That when we submit to God and when we obey God, when we fulfill our obligations, it is then that we actually find freedom. It's weird. We find our freedom when we obey. How is that possible? It's because you were designed to obey God. Simply put, that is your design. And as I said many, many times before, that when we get away from our original design, we're bound to abuse. Right? That's what this one writer said. When there is loss of purpose, you are bound to abuse. So when we lose our original purpose, then everything that we do is abuse. Case in point, you could take an iPhone 5. Brand spanking new, very, very popular. And you could use it as paperweight. Right? You put it on your desk to make sure your paper don't fly around everywhere. Can you do that? For sure. Is that what it was designed for? No. What are you doing? You're abusing that phone. Right? You can use a chair for many things. But what was it primarily designed for? It was designed for people's butts to be on it, in it, or whatever. And so that's the twist. That for us, it seems like our mind, everything in our minds and even our egos was saying, no, me subservient, me bowing down before or going under God seems like slavery. But the Bible says that's not slavery, that's freedom. Why? It's because when we obey God, that is our freedom because that is our design. That is what our true purpose is. Paul says it like this. It's in, I believe, Romans. says, do you not know that when you present yourselves to someone as slaves for obedience, you are slaves of the one whom you obey, either to sin, resulting in death, or of obedience, resulting in righteousness. But thanks be to God that though we were once slaves to sin, God made us obedient from the heart to the gospel. And having been freed from sin, you have now become slaves of righteousness. See that? We are slaves to the one that we obey. So in essence, we can talk about, man was created to be free, we were created to be independent. That's simply not the case. The Bible clearly writes that man was created to be dependent. How do I know this? Because I was a psych major, George Mason University down the street, right? You know what psychology tells me? That man, we are social creatures. Therefore, the worst form of punishment for any individual, man or woman, in the United States of America right now, in the penal system, that if you go to jail, the worst thing they could ever do to you is put you in the hole. You know what the hole is? Where they strip you butt naked and throw you into a little 2x4 cell. You literally sit, sleep, poop, eat, sometimes. Literally like a hole in the ground, like this. And at the most, they let you out of there for an hour a day. They have to, otherwise your mind goes crazy. Your human brain goes crazy. Psychology tells me also that within about 72 to 96 hours of complete sensory deprivation, that what that means is you're in the hole, okay? And there's no light, so you can't see anything. There's nothing, I guess you could smell stuff, but you can't hear anything because it's only you. Within 3 to 4 days of you being in there, your mind will break from reality because it needs input. And so your mind will start making stuff up that's not there. And so psychologists and sociologists tell us that the human animal is created for interaction. We are created to interact with our environment. We also especially created to interact with one another. So the idea that humans are created for independence, that's a lie. Right? The Bible says it clearly, that you are either slave to sin or you're slave to righteousness. You're dependent on something. Last lesson. God is better than his gifts. Okay. So where am I getting that from? It's in verse 25 and 26. Okay, so David uses a hypothetical if. Okay, there's a way you could do that, hypothetical if. Because it's like, you throw that if in there, and it's so absurd that everyone hearing it, you go, yeah, no, obviously that's absurd. You know, I mean, we kind of do that in English too. Right? Like, you throw in a ridiculous hypothetical if. Like, you know what? If Jay had a third arm, you guys would all know, if I started a sentence like that, you guys would know, okay, this is the ridiculous hypothetical if, right? Or, this is a better example. I like this example. Or when Jay said, is there a way, possibly, if I can lose my salvation, play video games, and then get it back? That's a ridiculous hypothetical if, right? That's a year ago, okay? Jay's gone past that. He's been more mature now, right? He doesn't think about those things anymore. Right, Jay? Okay. So David uses that hypothetical if, okay? And he says, if I find favor in the sight of the Lord. David knows this. All we have to do is turn to the book of Psalms and we see, okay? If I find favor in the sight of the Lord, then he will bring me back again show me both it and his habitation. But if he should say that I have no delight in you. Okay? So this is a ridiculous hypothetical if. However, he uses it to show us a very, very important lesson, which first is that David is saying, hey, check this out. God is God. I am not. God is king. Right? And that everyone acknowledges that. God is king. I am not. Furthermore, and here's the relationship part. Because so far, everything's been cerebral, mental. Here's the relational part. David's saying, God is God, I am not. But you know what? God is so much more better than all any stuff he can give me. Okay, that's the relational aspect. Right? In other words, Hanukkah can say, Johnny is this. He is a leader. He does praise, teaches the Bible, or something like that, right? Those are all just aspects or things about Johnny that almost anyone can know. When Hannah says, you know what? But Johnny is really good. He's really good to me. He watches over me. This is a little different. See that? And that's what David's shooting for. Right? That God is God. Almost especially in the company that he's in, no one's going to deny that. And then he says, but I'm not. That's a harder lesson, but they're like, okay, that's kind of weird, but go with you. And then David comes with this relational aspect. But we need that relationship. Maybe if you get to know God, then you don't see him just simply as a powerful king, but you see him as a good and loving king. Therefore, the stuff that he gives me, whether it be life, death, whether it be kingship, or I go back to being a penniless, you know, kid running around with smelly, stupid sheep, doesn't matter. God is still God, and he is more enjoyable than any stuff he can give. This is why David writes in one of his Psalms that God, your love is better to me than life. We sing these great songs, but I wonder how many times do we even really think about what we're singing? And secondly, do we even mean what we sing? I love it. I love the fact that we sang Heart of Worship. Because I think it's one of those songs that we sing a lot. And very quickly and very easily just kind of gloss over the words. Do you know that's the song that David was singing in this moment? While he's running for his life with nothing but the clothes on his back and some of his friends. That's the song he sings. God, it's all about you. It's all about you. You give me stuff, thank you, but you know what? You're better than the stuff you give. Let me ask you this. Do you love God more than the oxygen that he gives you right now? Do you love God more than the friends and the family that you have? Because I tell you, when I was preparing this message, I got to this point, it hit me like a freight train. Because there's so much stuff that he gave me that I love way too much. I have a car. I have a minivan. I don't even have to close doors anymore. It's fantastic. I have an apartment. Keeps me dry in the rain, usually. Keeps me cold in the summer, most of the time. That's a bad example. Okay. I have my brother. We had a lot of funny times growing up together. I love him. I'm going to delete that part before I upload it. But I wonder, do I love God more than my brother? That's what it means. This is what Jesus was shooting for when he said, If you will follow me, you must hate your mother and your father and your brother and your sister, your PS3, your phones, your friends, your grades, your future, your job, all of that stuff you must love. Me and hate those things. That's what he's talking about. Because he's saying this. Hey, guess what? You guys have tunnel vision. Tunnel vision. You're focusing on this little thing. Take a step back. Look at the whole picture. Do you love me or do you love the stuff that I give you? He gives us cool stuff. And I have to ask, do I love God more than my baby, more than my wife? For all of you guys, when you're about to get married and you get to that stage, that's something you got to ask yourself, something you got to talk about with your spouse. It gives you a sober reminder of what your marriage is supposed to be. That's not just about your other, you know, you're supposed to love your wife and your husband and all that stuff. That's true. Take a step back. You love your wife because, you know, of God in light of the great provider. So we have to realize that God is better than the stuff he gives. For the dead man, it is resurrection that is enjoyable. For the blind, it is sight. For the lame, it is to walk and run. For the thirsty, it is sweet, cool water. Guess what? God is all these things and more to us. So the last question, one of the most difficult questions I've ever had to deal with, and I still struggle with it time to time in my life, is this. We all want to go to heaven. At least I hope. That's why we're all here. But let me ask you this. Do you want to go to heaven to escape the fires of hell, or do you want to go to heaven because that's where Jesus is? That's a very difficult question. Say it again. Do you want to go to heaven because you want to escape fire from hell? Or do you want to go to heaven because that's where Jesus is? Let's pray.